you're having trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, then one of the best things you can possibly do is start getting enough magnesium. But please don't just run to the store and buy the first magnesium supplement that you find. There are actually 7 unique forms of magnesium, and you have to get all of them if you want to experience the calming, sleep-enhancing effects of it. And that's why I recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. You simply take 2 caps before bedtime, and you'll be amazed by how much better you feel in the morning when you wake up and how much just better you sleep that night. So for an exclusive offer just for my listeners only, go to magbreakthrough.com/wolfsden and use the code WOLFSDEN10 to save 10% when you try Magnesium Breakthrough. And for a limited time here, Bioptimizers is also giving away free bottles of their best-selling products, P3-OM and Masszymes, with select purchases. So go to magbreakthrough.com/wolfsden and get your exclusive 10% discount, plus the chance to get more than $50 worth of supplements for free. Hey, Jordan Belfort here, the Wolf of Wall Street and the Wolf's Den. I got a great guest today, financial guy, macroeconomic, let's say guru in the making. He's a young guy, but he's certainly built up a big following really fast here. He's got a top podcast in the crypto space, but from more an overall perspective and what crypto is doing to the world in terms of the changing in power structures and the old guard versus the new guard, where the world is going and how you can use that information to invest more wisely and hopefully make a ton of money. So I have Nathaniel Whitmore, right? Is it Whitmore?
Yeah, that's it. Yep, you got it.
All right. And or NLW, right? So let's start by you kind of explaining exactly what the role that your podcast serves in the overall world of, you know, financial podcasts. What are you trying to accomplish?
Sure. I mean, listen, I think that, you know, I've always been interested in power, and money is the biggest source of power in the world. When a new industry comes to challenge the way that the money system is organized, it's obviously going to be really interesting. And so I look at crypto a lot from that perspective, how Bitcoin and now other types of parts of the crypto scene are infiltrating traditional finance, what enemies they're creating along the way, what the potential implications are, all the way from kind of like very traditional Wall Street to people who are looking for financial empowerment and new tools and new access. So where I kind of fit in the crypto ecosystem is a lot about what crypto means for the world, or what it could mean, what the debates are about what it means, versus just, you know, here's sort of some micro movement around this asset or another. Not that those things aren't important; they're all part of the story. But that's kind of my perspective, is much more about what are the big pattern shifts we're seeing here.
And what's your background, education wise or business wise?
I was in Silicon Valley for a decade, actually. So I was a VC for a while. I, you know, was in tons of startups. I mean, everyone in Silicon, if you live in Silicon Valley for a decade, you do a million different things, right? Just by nature of it. And I was there when Bitcoin was getting heated up, but Silicon Valley actually kind of missed Bitcoin, which is interesting, because I think that they saw it as a technology versus what I think what it really is, which is a financial disruption, right? And so they tried to kind of pin it in this box of, oh, this is just another payments technology. It's competing with Square crypto, or with Square, you know, the Cash App or something like that, versus it being this kind of very different alternative money system. And I think it didn't click.
I think on some level, though, I think part of the miss, you could say, is that there's some sort of suspension of disbelief required here as to why the U.S. government and the other governments would allow this type of technology to exist when it absolutely does no good for the U.S. government, for any government, to have a Bitcoin or an Ethereum or any other alternative decentralized system out there to create money, to essentially move money around. Why would, to me, I mean, honestly, I looked at this and said, no way. I was like, there's no way they'll allow this to proliferate. They're going to squat to step this out. And I believe if they had a time machine, they can go back in time, they would. I think it's past that point where they can stamp it out easily. Now, China has done China's an authoritarian government. So they have a little bit more, you know, sort of largely just say end of story, and they could just shut it down. U.S. is more difficult. But I just couldn't wrap my arms around why would they allow an instrument that could be so easily used for money laundering, or simply just if imagine if it got so big that no longer if it actually was being used, they could no longer control the money supply to make economic, you know, to relieve, you know, alleviate depressions or whatever. So it just seems a very dangerous tool from a central government's perspective. That was my thesis.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think you're certainly not alone, right? Ray Dalio, who's now invested in Bitcoin, still has these concerns. I think what's interesting now is seeing what the government... So the government is now, I think, racing to catch up with itself about what its opinion actually is, right? It's been a decade kind of not really worrying about it, not really worrying about it, not really thinking about it. You know, somewhere benignly ignoring it, maybe like going after out-and-out frauds, but really kind of ignoring it, right? And now it's like, holy shit, this thing is big. It's a $2 trillion industry. People are transacting with this in a huge way. Billions and billions of dollars are being settled every day on these blockchains. Like we need an approach on this. And it's causing a lot of that reaction right now. What's interesting is figuring out or watching where it's causing the reaction. It's not really around Bitcoin so much or Ethereum, these things that are kind of like now in the zone of commodities, right? They trade like commodities. People see them as commodities. What the targets are set on right now are stable coins, right? These sort of approximations of US dollars that have stable value. They're used as settlement currency. They're used as on and off ramps for the crypto exchange markets. There are, as we're recording, a ton of sort of rumors, machinations of the Treasury Department in particular going after stable coins in a big way, kind of wrestling them into a regulatory framework. Now, what I think is interesting about it, though, is that there is, I think, a pretty open question about what power the central bank actually has around monetary policy in a world where the supply of euro dollars, you know, and offshore deposits is so much higher than the actual monetary supply they control. There's plenty of economists out there who think that the central bank has actually already lost power. So not that anything that you're saying is off, it's just it opens up a whole lot more questions than it shuts down. And I think ultimately the biggest thing is, you know, understanding not what would have made sense, but where what's likely to happen now that we are where we are, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's naive to think that the U.S. government can't do something if they wanted to. I just don't think the will exists right now. Or I'm long crypto. I'm in. So like, I guess like on some level, I feel a lot like Ray Dalio, and then I'm still wondering why are they allowing this to happen? Because it doesn't make sense. I mean, I know people personally that are doing things with crypto that are not right. Like they're using it to move money in ways that are not right. You know, they're not close friends. I know of a lot of people. So, you know, I'm not saying that. And by the way, Bitcoin's a very poor way to launder money. You know, I'm an expert at that stuff, unfortunately, my whole life. But it's not a particularly great money laundering mechanism. But there are other coins and blockchains that are far better for that. But I think what you said is true in the sense that like they're moving to stable coins. Why? Well, those are actually now, you know, more competing with traditional currencies. But I think also as this starts to take more hold, when you see Bitcoin or Ethereum, whatever it starts using for actual payments, you're going to, there's going to be some massive pushback from the central. I don't think the central bank is go down without a fight. Let's just say, I don't think they go down without a fight. And I think the biggest problem is that like as United States citizens, we tend to look at things from a very US centric perspective, but in other parts of the world, they don't have a stable currency. Like if you're from Argentina, their currency is shit. It devalues every single day. It's a real problem. Like, you know, so Bitcoin and these blockchains do solve a major problem outside of the United States. I think in the US, it's a bit dicier.
Yeah, well, listen, I think you're dead on. So a couple of things. One, I definitely agree with you. I am not in the camp of, well, bring it on. They can't do anything about it. If only from the standpoint of just me personally, right? Like, yes, I agree that if you tried to ban US, the Bitcoin from the US, the practical effect would just be banning US citizens from Bitcoin, right? That's how it would play. But that's why I don't want it. Like I'm invested in it. You know, I don't want I don't want to have to pick up and move to somewhere else. Right. So I'm with you on that.
I don't think they'll do that.
I definitely don't agree. It's more just if you play out these scenarios, there are some Bitcoiners who are like, bring it on, do whatever. I don't care. Right. And I'm not in that camp. I think that you're also right that the need and the market fit is different in parts of the world who are used to unstable monetary regimes, who are used to unstable political regimes where money can be seized more easily, you know, or assets and value can be seized more easily. Argentina is a great example to me because I've spent a lot of time down there. And this is a place that, you know, it's not like a failed state, like, you know, a Venezuela or something like that, right? It's thriving. It has tech unicorns. It has, you know, it's like there are tons of really smart people who are up and part of the global economy.
Contradiction terms almost.
Big time, but they still wake up every other year. And all of a sudden, if they have their money in the Argentine peso in their bank accounts, it's worth 30% less. Their life savings is worth 30% less than it was. And that's what got me hooked on Bitcoin as kind of an entree into this whole field is the idea that there was an opt-out for the first time of your local monetary regime that wasn't just sort of, you know, in Argentina, they have the blue notes where you can go kind of trade, you know, the...
There's three different types of currencies there. It's the crazy thing ever. Yeah. Even four sometimes is the... Blue, the white, the red. I know, it's insane.
Yeah,
it's
wild. So I think it's actually a great example of, you know, it having a different role in different parts of the world. And of course, we're talking about Bitcoin specifically. You know, I think that the thing that the US is going to have to figure out, and it doesn't surprise me that stablecoins are kind of under the investigative lens now, and DeFi is too. And I think that the reason that there's more sides of the story than just the part that you presented from a regulator's perspective, I think completely makes sense. If you're focused on the control that the US government has over the monetary system and the financial system, well, you're looking at the monetary system, stablecoins, and the financial system, DeFi, right? Now, the reason to be to move not slowly, but with consideration around something like decentralized finance is that one of the reasons the US has the power that it has in the world is the way that its government got out of the way in spite of itself oftentimes and let our markets be the strongest in the world. This is an industry that has gone from zero to $2 trillion with no one's help, with no government backstop, with no support in the course of a decade. And it's now transacting billions and billions of dollars a day back and forth, right? Settling huge sums more quickly, more rapidly, more easily, in many cases, more cheaply than the traditional financial system. You have to think if you're a US regulator and you're interested in the next generation of US financial power, you want to at least know if there are ways that you can harness that power, keep that industry regulated in your jurisdictions in ways that work for you. And it's not saying that the answer that they'll come up with is that they can, but if I'm a US regulator, that's what I'm asking right now.
There's a major distinction, though. I think there's a major distinction here between blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies. And I think they're like in a world where there are digital dollars or digital yuan, right? Those are not in any way related to cryptocurrencies or in a sense decentralized currencies. Like the problem here's the problem I have with it. And I'm long, I'm a bull, okay? But I'm looking for someone to explain to me how the US government is not going to somehow have to stamp this out to a large degree because they are. So let me just understand here. I got indicted. I went to jail, not for stocks, but for smuggling money to Switzerland, for money laundering. I took money to Switzerland and hid money there. The level of intensity that they take on money laundering, they spent 20 years strangleholding Switzerland to make them cough up the name of every single US person. And it was such a big deal that Swiss accounts, Bahamian accounts, Cayman Island accounts were just this worst thing ever. And they did it pretty much. They had a really, you know, they made it to the point you couldn't even open up an account in Switzerland as a US citizen. So now I say, okay, Bitcoiners, do it your way. And they just, I don't get it. It doesn't seem to me why on earth would they allow this to happen? They're going to have to do something, it would seem, to make it so that they have control. While the technology is great and everything, it's powerful. It just seems to be counterintuitive to anything that makes sense for a large central government. Don't you think?
Not necessarily. So I think that what you're dead on about, though, and what we can see with the way that the sort of the regulatory landscape is changing is in the US, mainstream, and by mainstream, I mean pretty much all use of cryptocurrencies in any way, is going to be KYC to the tits, right? Like that is just, it is going to be, and it's probably going to be a more severe KYC AML regime than exists for other aspects of the world, right? Because there's more reasons to be scared. There's all these questions, yada, yada, yada. Like you're seeing this right now. There's a mass movement of exchanges to make sure that they're all KYC'd. There's exchanges who are trying to make sure that even their international customers, there's better tools that they have for getting things. So, you know, the question I think, and this I do believe will be challenged in certain cases in courts, are what rights does the U.S. like, how far does the U.S. rights for anti-money laundering, for bank information go, right? And this is a broader battle than just crypto, right? You're seeing right now community banks being, you know, kind of subpoenaed to have their citizens report, or their all transactions over $600.
Crazy.
Yeah, be reported, right? Like, and there's just no way that doesn't get challenged. I think crypto is going to be a part of that. I think crypto is going to be a leading edge of that. I think that you're going to have regulated paths for crypto in the US where people see, and if you can prove that you're not doing anything wrong, it's fine. Because again, it's not necessarily like crypto isn't realistically right now competing with the US dollar as a thing that people use day to day. You know, it's a settlement currency. It's being used, like tokens in the DeFi ecosystem are being used as incentive structures for people in the system. Like it's creating a different type of plumbing. I know what you're saying. I agree.
I Bitcoin. Listen. I'll tell you what I think. I think that Bitcoin has been very smart in the sense the way they pivoted the story to digital gold versus a currency. I think that's what saved Bitcoin. Because honestly, I think that if you were trying, if this really was being tried to use as a currency, they would. I really believe they would have stamped it out. But a digital gold isn't really a dangerous thing to a central bank. It's really not. It's, the only thing is digital gold that can be moved with the ease of, like the thing is you can't move gold bullion unless you're a gold finger from James Bond. You have to make it into a car and transport it on a plane. So it was never very good for moving large amounts of money undetected. That's why gold was never a threat to central governments. They even did away with the gold standard in the 73 or 74, right? But the point is with Bitcoin, it's like as digital gold, it doesn't hurt any government. It doesn't really compete with anything. It really doesn't. But what happens is, though, is this other side. Like today, I received a $150,000 payment in Bitcoin for a speech I'm doing in 3 months. Wham, I got the money in literally a second. Now me, I call my book, put that on my general ledger. I received 150.
Yeah.
And so to me, I'll say it out loud. Yeah, I got 150 and I reported it as income. And that's that. And then and I'm sure many, many people, most people, I'm sure 95% of the world will do that because they're whatever. It's just another value received. So you're going to not, why would you want to get in trouble? But the point is you can see how it could get out of hand for people trying to use it in nefarious ways, especially the privacy coins. My question to you is, do you think that what really allowed Bitcoin to proliferate the way it did was that it almost started off that, like in Satoshi's mind, it was going to be for payments. And then it kind of pivoted into no. And the way the developers took it is they took it towards a value, a storage of value and not for payments. And Bitcoin Cash sort of went that way and didn't really go anywhere. What are your thoughts on that?
I absolutely think that Bitcoin was able to run under the radar and run not afoul of regulators for so long for that reason, that it was, you know, I think that there, none of us know what was exactly on Satoshi's mind and what balance of store value versus, you know, transactions they had in mind, but it kind of doesn't matter. Almost immediately, the people, like every new person who got more excited about and invested in Bitcoin saw it as somewhere between a speculative asset and a store of value. There's just how long their speculation was, right? And because of that, it very quickly became this digital gold. The narrative caught up to it, right? Where people just explained exactly how it was being used. A digital gold that has real-time settlement cross borders is fucking powerful, right? That's awesome.
That's the other part. That's powerful, right? It's like gold on steroids.
Exactly. And you know, I think that there are plenty of people out there who are Bitcoin bulls who don't think that the world is going to hyper Bitcoinization that still look at the total global market cap for gold and say, well, what's the version of that when it actually actually has liquidity, when it can move fast, when it can be used as a settlement currency, when you need to go to something else, it can go fast. Does that mean it's you know, 1x the gold cap? Is it 1.5x? Is it 2x? What's the number, right? And they have that. That's like their very real. And again, these aren't the sort of hyper Bitcoin maximalists who believe in hyper Bitcoinization. It's just kind of a rational, like, what is gold but better worth for a new generation, right?
And I kind of like that. That to me, that's the view that I think is this more sober view than this, like, the dollar's going to be gone in 3 years. I just think that's freaking nonsense. To me, you know, I really believe that's utter nonsense, that it's going to be, you know, I just don't see that happening without some sort of cataclysmic event like that takes place, where the dollar vanishes as the reserve currency. And I don't think the United States realize just how awful that would be for the United States if it ever was no longer the reserve currency, because we have so many advantages as the reserve, as the global reserve currency. We go buy homes for 1% interest, we buy cars for no money down. You can't do that in other countries where it's not the reserve currency, because if you try that type of liberal monetary policy, your currency would devalue and basically you'd have hyperinflation and so forth. So on some level, it scares me to think that that you know, is like, it's almost like we're the best bad solution out there is the Fed in some level.
I think that's how a lot of people who are like hyper-rationalists look at it like that, that, you know, and even again, let me give you the Bitcoiner case in that world. You just have an alternative that if you want to opt out a little bit, like still enjoy that, but opt out a little bit, there it is for you. It's your hedge against what you believe might come while still playing in that system. So for people who feel that way here in America, that's what it is for them. For people who are in Argentina, it's a little bit more pertinent. I think that's why, you know, there are plenty of folks out there who are excited about lots of different things in crypto, but always come back to, or keep coming back to, kind of Bitcoin as this core thing that does make sense, that fits in the world, you know?
The biggest problem I have with the whole thing is the proliferation of shit coins that have been created for only one reason and one reason alone: to separate unsuspecting people from their money. So for every great blockchain that has a utility or some really clever innovation that creates a coin or a token that actually makes sense, there are all of these shit tokens, shit coins that literally are freaking worthless. They're all pump and dumps, and they're literally going out there and with zero, almost with total impunity, zero regulation. And this is why I fault the US government, because see, I think crypto should be heavily regulated. And if it is heavily regulated, it will go much higher. The real stuff, the cream will rise to the top dramatically. Every time you see intense regulation coming to a market, it doesn't make the market worse. It makes it better. Like, I've seen it happen over many, like over 40 years. I've been around, believe it or not, 35 years in the market. All right. And I've watched every time, oh my God, the regulators are in. It's the end of junk bonds. It's the end of mortgages. It's the end of this. And every time they come in and they do, it's the end of NASDAQ. I've seen that. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger whenever regulation comes in, because people have more confidence, institutional money gets involved. And I think that's what the mistake US is making. They're allowing all of these scams to occur. And it's insane. It's really insane.
Well, this is, I mean, if you listen to kind of the mainstream of the Bitcoin and crypto industry over the last few years, this is what they've been screaming. First at Jay Clayton's SEC and then at Gary Gensler's SEC, is create an actual regulatory framework that's not just pointing at Howie 90 years ago and saying, Howie, 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 Howie. I mean, that's the extent of our thing. And then we have Sam Bankman-Fried, the CEO of FTX, who, disclosure, I work with on marketing as well, which people know from my podcast, was on the CoinDesk TV show this morning, literally said exactly what you just said. Every exchange CEO that's above board, every person who's in these things, they all say the same thing. Even, I will say, there are plenty of like these DeFi protocol founders and people like that who are definitely flirting with the lines of what is and isn't going to be allowed, but want to have the conversation because they're acting in good faith, right? They're saying, this is the type of thing that we should be able to do. Here's our case. Here's our path to dissent. You know, like there's a ton of good faith actors who at some point, you know what, the US might say, like, sorry, but you know, no, but at least they'll have that conversation versus what you're talking about, which has been such a huge part of the industry. Now, I guess the one thing I'll say that's an optimistic note from a free market kind of perspective is that the number of people who are getting fleeced by that sort of shit in 2021 is very different than what's happening in 2017. 2017 was the absolute heyday for, you spin up a website, you know, put your face six times with different mustaches and facial, you know, expressions as you're your team and you raise a $20 million ICO, you know, and the SEC is still prosecuting those things to this day. But it's a little frustrating for those of us in the industry that the SEC is kind of holding up. Like they just prosecuted Bitcoin, or they just had a punishment come down for BitConnect, which is like BitConnect was so many years ago. It's this thing that like we all make fun of as the archetype of a scam, and we're supposed to give them a gold star for prosecuting them now. If your job is investor protections, if that's all you care about, maybe get on BitConnect a little earlier than a full college education later after they've ridden off into the sun.
No, and also I just think that, like, for example, there's this mistaken notion out there, like, you know, you have all these influencers that are out there pumping up these shit coins and getting, I get three times a day, I get offered shit coins in exchange for, I never done it, but, you know, I know a lot of influencers and big ones that have been doing it, and they are out there publicly promoting worthless coins. And like they'll say, "Bam, this is not financial advice." Tell that to the jury when they sentence you. It's like, just because you say, you know, you give financial advice, but it's not financial advice.
I mean, it's my favorite.
It work. It's like so ridiculous. It's like, and some of these people are my friends or acquaintances. I'm like, wake up, guys. You can't do this. You just can't do this. Oh, but there's no SEC. Doesn't matter. Just the FBI will come in. If there's no, there's always a U.S. attorney, by the way, because they just, it's worse when there's no SEC, because SEC at least is civil. The U.S. attorney comes in and it's criminal. So it's like, I really fault the U.S. government so much for this. And they've done such a terrible, lousy fucking job of protecting people and being so slow. And like, give clarity. And I think clarity will allow the legitimate blockchains and tokens to rise to the top. And it will give transparency to what's still a very opaque, dark market. My experience with opaque, dark markets is there's always bad shit going on whenever there's no transparency. And it's a combination of human nature, just the way spreads work. Like the spreads are so massive. Why do you think Coinbase makes so much money? The spreads are utterly, they're ludicrously ridiculous, that to the point. So something has got to give. And I think once it does, I think you even see a short-term pullback. I think you'll see the greater stuff really take off in a massive way. What are your thoughts on that?
100%. I literally could not agree more. When I've talked to, you know, long-term investment thesis with like my father-in-law, for example, you know, I basically just laid out exactly what you just said, you know, and I think it's inevitable, and that inflection point is coming, right? It's coming right now. I think the next 18 months
are
going to be a ton of that. I think there are going to be a ton of that. I think it's going to be painful along the way in many cases. I don't know.
All right. Want to grow your business? Diversify your content? You're not going to find a better tool out there than Melon for your live streaming needs. Blazing fast response time, low CPU usage, all available right in your browser. Go to melonapp.com/wolf and start streaming today.
So given that we agree, we really do agree on, I think we're very much aligned in this. What are your thoughts? So knowing this, let's say you want, everyone who's listening wants to take this information as this is really kind of like pretty much, no one knows for sure, but that's a very sober, logical thesis to what's been happening and what is going to happen. Knowing that, then how do you act? So what do you do? What should a person be doing right now? Should you be buying just Bitcoin? Should you be buying Bitcoin, Ethereum, and the other top three, you know, or five, top coins? Should you be going after the newer offerings and try to be researching the level of expertise of management or the utility of these new offerings? What do you do?
I mean, I think that, first of all, everyone has to figure it out for themselves a little bit, right? Second of all, I am not a good short-term trader. And I think the short-term trader answers to these questions would be short, even medium-term, like probably different, you know?
I agree. I mean, I do know everything I buy, I'm saying I'm holding until it's either zero or a million. That's my
guess. Yeah, exactly. I'm very much in that set. And so I think, you know, Bitcoin is the only thing that I've like consistently advised people to get into. I just think it's too established, and it makes too much sense in too many parts of the world and in too many different contexts. And it's this use case whack-a-mole where, you know, I mean, listen, Bitcoin or China really effectively banned the thing this year, and people were freaking out at first. We had a crash, you know, of about 10,000 off the price. All of the mining went offline in China, you know, 50% of the hash power in the network. We're back up 50% of what we lost on that hash power. It's moved to North America, where it's better regulated. It's cleaner energy sources. All of a sudden, there's no more concern about the CCP taking over the network because of mining. And we're like, wait a second, did the network just get way stronger, even though this big kind of scary FUD thing happened? So Bitcoin's the one for me that's sort of always obvious. I think in terms of other things, it's about like what conviction does one have around the future? I think the reason that a lot of people have gotten conviction around Ethereum is the idea of adding this programmable layer to financial value transfers on the internet is something that has so many use cases that's so valuable. And I guess that the way that I might apply this this heuristic of kind of what the next 18 months, you know, to 3 years look like that you and I share is, do you think on the other side of that, some amount of the value of the programmability of financial value transfer is going to still be there? And if you do, smart contract platforms, be it Ethereum or something else, are really interesting. Now, I think that the clarity of those investments is really different. In some ways, I feel like we're still kind of in a bit of a game where a lot of crypto investors are just trying to figure out what other people think, you know? And so to some extent, the question from a positioning standpoint is, what do you think other people are going to think when the US comes and regulates? Do you think it's going to be a big buying opportunity for some of the things that are getting hammered? And if so, which are the things that you think are going to come out the other side? Is it the things that have the best treasuries, the things that have the most unique value proposition? I think a lot of let's put it this way, a lot of the stuff that did survive the crash after 2017 will not, I don't believe, survive the sort of a regulatory culling that comes through. There's a lot of kind of zombie chains and zombie coins that have just been floating around forever that, you know, I think will more or less go away. But
you know what I think? I think that to me, I find Ethereum to be a bit perplexing because here you have what arguably is really almost like the backbone of the whole thing of what, you know, it's like everything is being built on this protocol, right? And it's sort of, and that to me is what gives Ethereum value, that it's like sort of the chain which all things, many, many things are being built, right? The problem is it sucks. It doesn't work that well. It doesn't work. It's expensive. It's slow. It's having tremendous problems moving from proof of work to proof of stake. And one would think that a more nimble proof of stake solution ultimately would take over it. But yet so much is being built on the back of Ethereum that I personally have set like an end of year target. I'm not selling, nor this truly is not financial. I'm just talking out loud to you. Like in my mind, I think I could see it easily, you know, doubling or tripling from not by tripling already from where it is today. But the point is that it's still, but what balls me is or perplexes me is that it kind of sucks. Like it would seem that it should have been better by now. Why is it not being fixed? Is it not being fixed on purpose? Like why? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that the central issue, and I don't know the best way to resolve it, you know, the Ethereum community kind of is debating this constantly, but so Bitcoin's trade-offs are very clear. It is a hyper-conservative chain, right? That like cares about censorship resistance and sort of not breaking, not fucking up, not ruining more than anything else, right? And so it changes very slowly. It's not good for kind of day-to-day transactions. The Lightning Network is pushing that in different directions. But like Bitcoin as a chain knows what its trade-offs are and right. It's very comfortable with them and it's
fine. It goes in the path and it's done a very good job, right, at protecting the core thesis of what Bitcoin comes to represent.
Yeah, decentralization is fundamental and irreconcilable. The unchangeability of monetary policy is fundamental. And, you know, like it's a part that you can't extract.
And I think that's what scares probably the US the most.
Yeah.
Like that you understand essential.
Yeah, those, totally.
That's the frightening part for them is that it's immutable. You can't print more. You can't, you know, add to the system when things are slow or take back. Or, I mean, you know, the other side of the equation is, yeah, but that's what's doing all the harm.
Right. Exactly.
And that's that story, right? But anyway, keep going.
Yeah. So I think that the challenge for Ethereum is Ethereum kind of lives in this middle space where it also thinks that decentralization is really important and that like a good monetary policy for the long term is perhaps deflationary, right? They just voted on a EIP 1559, which is an Ethereum improvement protocol that kind of will net net burn more Ethereum than is actually issued. So it believes those things, but it also wants this super high performance because all of these financial rails are being built on top of it. And so it's really a servant of two masters in some ways. It's the servant of the decentralization thesis, the need for sort of sound money thesis, but it's also a servant of tons of developers want to build a new set of financial rails on it, and it's seriously bandwidth constrained in what it can do. Into that gap have come a new set of protocols that are, well, no, not even layer two on Ethereum.
Two chains.
A new set of layer one competitors, Solana, Avalanche, you know, et cetera, who are basically making a different trade-off than Ethereum. So, you know, Solana is basically saying that having fees in excess of what people are willing to pay, having slow performance is a failure of the chain. So they have, you know, people in the Ethereum community hate Solana for how not decentralized it is. It only has 600 or 700 validators. That was a few months ago. I don't know if it's more. That has 1,100 node validators to Ethereum's thousands and thousands. But, you know, like, but I think what's going to be very interesting in the markets is Solana's very existence is basically saying that Ethereum has the trade-offs wrong for a layer one smart contract chain. And decentralization is important, but there's a certain threshold of decentralization that's important where it's protected from certain things. You can't just knock it offline, but you don't need to go so far that you lose performance as well. And I don't know what's right or wrong. These are going to be battles that are fought out, but I will say that watching the meteoric rise from a price standpoint of both Solana and Avalanche this year tells me that the market is not convinced that Ethereum's weighing of the trade-offs are the correct ones and that there's going to be pretty fierce competition for that. I don't know if that means that, I don't think that it necessarily means that one of those beat Ethereum long-term, but there's certainly, whereas I think Bitcoin has pretty clarity around the people who agree with that thesis, you know, it's really an interesting challenge with the rest of them. And this is not really a value judgment on any of these chains. I just think it's a, when they speak of sort of what's been firm fixed or not, you know, I don't know. I mean, listen, there could be a thing that's even faster, that's even less decentralized than Solana that's comes next year, you know, and is like, really all you need is, you know, a slightly more decentralized corporate structure. And here it is. And maybe that'll work better. You know, like it's hard to say.
If you look at it by use the parallel of the, you know, the rise of the internet and starting with like, you know, it started off, you had like AltaVista and these different like, you know, search engines, that Netscape, then that was supposed to be the great way. Then suddenly out of nowhere, Google comes along and comes up with a better way of figuring out how to come up with relevant searches, right? You know, the whole thing of stop moving away from keywords into who's using more like links to sort find who is the most important person or most important piece of information in the room, right? And then watching him with like how things like Friendster and MySpace and all these earlier versions of social networks that almost had it right, but didn't quite have it right. And then suddenly Facebook comes along and gets it right and bam, just literally overnight destroys the others. Do you see that type of thing possibly happening in the world of crypto?
Well, I think that it depends on what use of crypto you're asking for. I think that, here's the trade-off, or here's the inflection point. At some point, those networks built network effects where there was never going to be another MySpace to Facebook jump, right? And that's kind of what you've seen. Facebook has been, now Facebook is on the decline in some ways, right? In terms of what we see as engagement, but the thing still has more than 2 billion monthly active users, right? As much as the other chains have come up, there haven't been able to take, there hasn't been just a better Facebook, even though all these other social networks have proliferated, right?
Yeah, I think you have a different, like as you point out, there's different use cases. Like if you look at like, for example, TikTok is just taking over. But then again, TikTok is not a place that you would ever go to find out what your friends are doing. TikTok is a place you're going to get, it's almost like a shorter form of YouTube. It's like YouTube on steroids.
They invented a new content medium. You know, like, I mean, by the way, this is why I think anytime that a crypto powered social network comes up and says, we're going to be the next thing just because we give you crypto for your posts, I think it's total BS. I think like,
That whole idea, like with democratizing social media, I've heard it.
People care about the network that's there, and when Instagram came out, it figured out these like fun photo filters. That was their content innovation. When Snapchat came out, it figured out this short form expiring thing. You know, like it's always a different type of content that makes a new network. No one's ever tried to replace Facebook as the social graph, right? As the all of your people live there. Anyways, the point though is that I think that it's very clear that the smart contract wars are still being fought, and that that sort of technology, like there's a better technology around the corner play. Like, I mean, this year suggests that people are still pretty damn open to that as an idea. You know, I think that the question is, will any of these networks in the smart contract space get to the network effect where people stop trying or stop having success trying to peel off users? Right now, I mean, Solana's making a hell of an insurgency trying to peel off users and developers who just don't think that it's fast enough. They're sick of waiting around. And, you know, it seems to be working. Same with Avalanche, same with all these other networks. I think that the funny thing is, like, you know, to what extent would we see a world in which Ethereum heads the other direction and actually starts to lean into its sort of ultrasound money thesis and try to compete with Bitcoin as the long-term, you know, store of value asset? I think the challenge for them there is, we, even though he's so removed, we know who the founder is, you know, like they've changed monetary policy a few times. So, you know what I mean? It's like, it's just a harder argument for people to buy into. So I think it's going to be really interesting. You know, I don't know. I don't think that we'll see kind of revolutions in technology change every kind of few minutes or anything like that. But, you know, there's clearly still a lot of openness.
It would seem that, like in the case of Bitcoin, that, you know, they've sort of locked up this store of value. That would be odd, though, to think that the first person got it right. Like, in other words, like look how many evolutions of social networks it took to get to one that actually sort of had it figured right. It just seems pretty odd that you would have like the very first one just saying that's it and just stuck forever and that was it. That it just, but maybe they just got it right, you know. But I think the other side of this is, I look at, like, okay, go back in history and you see all of these situations where you have two competing versions of similar technology. For example, it was Betamax and VHS. And Betamax was actually the better technology, better clarity, better, and so Sony Betamax. But VHS had the sort of open source, mm-hmm. and VHS ended up winning the day, and there are no more Betamaxes. You sort of, same thing happened with Blu-ray tech now, Blu-ray and there was Laserdisc, right? And Blu-ray won again because it ended up getting the content providers behind Blu-ray, and that ended up, you know, becoming the standard. What you didn't see happen in that case, and I think with in terms of like decentralized versus centralized funds, I ultimately think it happens very much the way it happened with iPhone and Android. You have these two competing technologies, they're the same. Ultimately, while one might be the premier iPhone, Android has a much bigger market share because it's made up of like 75 other companies. Right. Anyone can use one. So do you think on some level, like it, you know, if you had to project in your mind for 10 years, 20 years, do you think it's sort of like, you know, centralized banks and cryptos are like iPhone and Android? What do you think? How do you think it ultimately plays out?
Yeah, I think humans are humans. And markets are markets, and there's going to be concentration around certain parts, and then there's going to be big open spaces that are constantly competing. Dealing with monetary technologies, as long as there's a financial incentive to try to push something new, to try to get new adoption, there's going to be challengers, there's going to be changes, there's going to be, you know, differentiators. I do think it feels highly likely to me that we'll see sort of a spectrum of options for developers and different use cases around like how centralized versus decentralized things need to be. I think that kind of, you know, it feels to me like there's clearly a difference between just a company offering a new blockchain that's, you know, the IBM blockchain and Solana's, you know, with its validator set. There's also, you know, I think the question is like, how big a gap is that? And then the question is, how big a gap is it from Solana to Ethereum in terms of those things? And does the market, do different parts of the market actually value those different gaps? Or is there some part that actually gets kind of mushy in the middle? And if you don't run to one side or the other, it's no good, you know? And that, I think, is going to be the question for the next few years. But I think a ton of people are going to make a lot of money arguing their version of which of those things is going to happen in the next couple of years. And frankly, you probably can't go wrong making a bet alongside, almost any of them, as long as there's enough conviction behind it.
What do you think about the staking world?
In terms of the...
ultra high interest rates people are getting and in the DeFi world. What do you think about that? You think that it's a pyramid scheme that's going to be massive hell to pay at some point? It's going to unravel?
I guess as a starting point, just going back to kind of the regulatory conversation, it's pretty clear that that's the first thing they're going after. I mean, the SEC has come down super well, not the SEC yet, but you've got now Texas, Alabama, and New Jersey who are all going after Celsius. That was just announced at the end of last week around sort of high yield products. You've got those states plus, I think, three more going after BlockFi. BlockFi is now getting kind of publicly, pushbacky and saying the SEC needs to say something about this. We're not going to make policy based on states. You've got, you know, Brian Armstrong, the CEO of Coinbase, kind of putting Gensler and the SEC on blast around this threads. But then today, I think I just saw right before we jumped on that they're not doing their product. Yeah. So there's that whole side. I think that the going back where you started this conversation was not like, here's what I think, but when I put myself in the shoes of a US regulator of the US government, here's what I would see, or here's what would be really easy to see. I think if you apply that same logic to, you know, a world in which, you know, a 0.5% savings rate is a great yield right now for the average US bank account, and then a crypto lending product is offering you 4%, 5%, whatever, you know, whether it's legitimate or not, the people are going to, their eyeballs are going to light up, you know? So I think that that's a conversation that's going to have to be, that one's has to get hashed out inside
the government. 5%, 99% APYs.
Well, that's, I mean, I guess that, you know, I don't know, like, I think a lot of it's wild, a lot, like, that's where risk in 2017 was, you buy some stupid crappy ICO coin that, you know, the people who were invited to participate in that round earlier than you are just going to dump the second it goes to ICO, right? That was risk then, and it happened constantly in and out. Risk in 2020 and 2021 around these DeFi protocols is you have some crazy yield farming thing like that. You stick your money in that, the protocol gets hacked, or the protocol is just there's a rug pull or whatever it is, you know? And so, I mean, listen, I personally, like, again, nothing of this is financial advice. I didn't dive into any of that, which is probably stupid financially, but it was just like, I don't have the bandwidth, the time to figure out which of these things are real, you know, which are, and for what period they're real and how they're real or for how long, and get out before, you know, something goes crazy. But, you know, listen, things that look too good to be true in the long run are too good to be true.
Yep. I think it's really good advice, by the way. Lastly, just for the people watching, you know, without you giving financial advice, you think, you know, for you is Bitcoin your major investment? Anything else that you would say is worth at least people taking a look at?
I think that people should, if you want to go into crypto, it's very easy to buy Bitcoin. If you want to kind of do, like, I mean, listen, for me, the store value of Bitcoin thesis is super easy and clear. I think that for the average kind of crypto holder across, like, you know, averaged out, the core blue chips of Bitcoin and Ethereum are clear. And you see that even in how the traditional financial world is getting into it. They're getting more interested in Ethereum as well because of this sort of performance. I think that if you go down the rabbit hole, figuring out what your thesis around DeFi is and what that means in terms of those protocols and chains. Also, I think you have to add the regulatory landscape to that. And then I think, like, these layer one battles, as you can tell, they're clearly interesting to me. I think there's a ton of financial opportunity in there. One of the smartest investors in the space, Sue from Three Arrows Capital, basically was just like, look, you know, these layer one battles are real. If you know, everyone in there that has a portfolio should have Bitcoin and Ethereum. But if you want to make a ton of money in the years to come, go look at the DeFi that's going to be built on Avalanche and Solana and all these competitors, you know? So that's his thesis. And then there's a whole thing that we didn't touch on at all, which is this whole NFT thing, which is like a crazy different side of the space, which has its own ins and outs and interesting things, you know, but is still kind of... NFTs. I think that it's almost like a microcosm of everything else in crypto. I think that some of them are real. A lot of them are going to go to zero. In fact, the vast majority of things that are out there right now are going to zero. I think that some of the prices that seem inflated will look cheap in the long run. I think that most of the prices that look inflated actually are. I think that the, you know, in some ways, the core obvious thing to me is, like, of course, like, humans love collecting shit and we love status symbols. Like, give us collectible status symbols online that are sort of, you know, digitally provable. And people love to tear into it. They're like, well, it's not digitally provable and all this sort of stuff. It's like, yeah, but it doesn't matter if the community agrees. If the community that you care about impressing thinks that you're the owner of this CryptoPunk or this Bored Ape, it doesn't matter if some other chain can copy the thing and say, look, there's more copies, so it's not valuable. Like, you have the status of the people that you want the status from. That's the game of status, you know? So I think that they're like, ultimately, NFTs are a great example of, it doesn't matter what you think. If you think they're dumb, if enough people think that you're wrong, that's all you need. Like, the market is made by the 1% of people who don't think they're crazy, or the 5% or the 10%, not the 90% of people who do think they're crazy. So I think that the digital art collectibles, like, look, man, a lot of people have gotten really rich in crypto over the last 10 years, and they now have a unique status indicator. So I think that those are likely going to be a thing. Whether in the long term, you know, does NBA Top Shot flourish? Do we see moments? You know, like, I think there's a lot of things that are going to be experimented with, but, you know, human, I never bet against, in the long term, things that have been true forever, like humans' desire to have status and show their status, you know?
Right. No, it makes sense. Listen, buddy, it's been a pleasure, Toy. I could talk to you all day, but all great things must come to an end. Thanks for coming on the show. Where can people find out more about your show and everything else?
I'm very easy to find. I'm at NLW on basically every network. The show, The Breakdown, is on, it's distributed by CoinDesk. So if you go to coindesk.com any day, you'll see the show on there on the homepage. But yeah, hit me up on Twitter is the easiest spot, but I'm everywhere.
Sounds good, my friend. Thanks for coming on the show, everybody. Nathaniel Whitmore, very smart man, knows his stuff, and he's got a pretty solid vision, I think. I agree with almost everything that you say, so that's rare. But thanks for coming on the show. It was really fun.
Thanks for having me.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.